I just saw the movie for the first time yesterday, actually. A theater in Bethesda is still showing it. And I loved it. I mean, I was tearing up at some point. I was, you know, I wanted to get back out there and hit people around again. It was bringing back... It's bringing back some good memories. So I guess we can just start off by, you just want to start by telling me how this project came about?
I had a partner in a nonfiction film for many years named Seth Gordon. We've made a couple of films together, New York Doll, King of Kong. And in March of 2009, he called and said there was these young filmmakers who'd reached out, and they had this football doc that they wanted to do. And at first, I was hesitant because of my job at ESPN. I kind of get my fill football. So when I wear the producing hat, I tend to look for different types of material to go and make a film about. But we met with the guys, and they're really smart. They made a film that I liked and thought was well done. And so we decided to back them to go on a trip. And they took a trip down to Memphis and brought their cameras. And when they came back, they showed us what they had shot. And it was obvious that not only were they the right guys to tell a story, but there was the opportunity here for some amazing documentation of a group of kids who were under tremendous stress because of their environment, but were fighting and were really good kids. And also just the intimacy with which they wanted to shoot and how close they wanted to get to these folks was really intriguing. So we got behind them and helped get all the financing together and get them on the road, get their equipment, and they moved to Memphis for 9 months, which was a pretty big commitment, obviously.
Yeah, 9 months is a huge commitment. Do you know how exactly they found this specific team, the Manassas Tigers?
There was an article in the Memphis Commercial Appeal about one of the players on the team named O.C. Brown. And O.C. becomes one of the main three kids we feature in the film. He had the most upside athletically, had, you know, the old story that, but his academics weren't keeping up with his athletics. And so it was just a story about how a couple of these volunteer coaches had opened up their home to let OC stay the night during the week so that he could get tutoring. And then you find out why he had to go to their house for tutoring. It's because the tutors would not physically go into OC's neighborhood for fear of their lives. And so that article made them think, obviously, a little bit of the story around the blind side, which happened in the exact same area, but more about what these kids had to do to have a chance. I didn't grow up in a place where a tutor would be afraid to come to my house at night to help me with algebra, and these young men did. So they saw something there that might be more. And then when they got there and met Bill Courtney, who was one of the volunteer coaches who becomes featured in the film, became obvious that there was some great people there to kind of tell the story through.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Bill next. He's definitely a character. do you know if the guys, did they start off thinking he would be their protagonist, or did they just kind of show up and it kind of happened that way?
You know, when you, and we've done enough of these to know that it's like being at a cocktail party. When you're making a documentary, the camera just starts going to the most interesting person in the room. And so as long as you stay open while you're in the environment, those things really start to become obvious. If you're just listening and paying attention and following the story of the people's lives, the most interesting people almost always bubble to the surface. And clearly, Coach Bill early on was going to be something that the cameras were just going to focus on a lot. And as time wears on, you start to realize you're capturing a lot of things happening in this guy's life. So I think it's both natural for the camera to start following the most interesting people, but I think over time you also start to make choices to focus in on certain individuals over others. And Coach Bill obviously warranted that. He's a colorful guy. He's very honest. He's got a great, strong moral compass, yet he's not a perfect person. So there was all of these reasons to follow Coach Bill, and the truth is he's as good a man as you'll ever meet.
Absolutely. And in addition to just, you know, Coach Courtney, the film really has some fascinating character arcs with the players that you guys explored. You know, you have OC, the hot college prospect. There's Money, who's, you know, dogged by some injuries, and then Chavis, who's kind of the hot-tempered guy who reforms himself. All three of them, you know, you weave pretty well throughout the whole thing. How'd you go about finding those individual storylines? Did those just kind of come about organically, just like with Coach Courtney?
Yeah, they followed. You know, we could probably make that movie and focus on a dozen or so players. you know, when you're with a team and when you're with a group of people that much, you follow just a lot of different people through their ups and downs of life. And then, again, through the camera, kind of finding the most interesting. And then through the edit process, you start to decide, okay, who are the people that we want to profile in a way that we can show what happened to them over this course of time, both the good and the bad. And, you know, the whole reason the filmmakers first went there was because of O.C. Brown. So it was kind of obvious that he was going to be someone we'd want to focus on. And they also, on their first trip, met Money, which is Montrell Brown, who right away we just realized was just this sweethearted kid who was doing everything he could to be a success. And yet he was in an environment that didn't always support that. And just his earnest desire to improve his life was just fascinating. And so we kind of knew he would become one of the guys we'd want to file. And then Chavis was just an absolute out of the blue. Here comes a guy no one had talked about before. He literally shows up in the parking lot. You know, there's a scene in the film where Chavis shows up with his mother for the first day he's gotten out of a youth penitentiary that he's been in for 15 months. And so that's just one of those happy accidents when you're doing an immersive documentary that you're there for. And I think it speaks to the dedication of the two directors and the producer who went, Rich Middlemiss, that they stuck with it and were there every single day. And that's why you're able to find a guy like Chavis and show the real-time reintroduction of him to the team.
Yeah, no, it sounds like it was a great combination of having a plan going in with OC, but then also being open to the flexibility of whatever comes along. You'd mentioned that the crew went down for, you said, 9 months?
Yeah.
Do you mind taking me through a little more of the logistics of shooting the thing? You know, how many cameras they had at each practice, how many practices they went to, how many cameras they had at the games, that kind of thing?
Yeah. I think one of the things that sets this documentary apart, and I'm not saying for better or worse, just different than a lot of films, is a lot of documentaries, and some that I've worked on, you go in and check in on certain events and times during people's lives, but you're not there every day. And this project was truly like some of the great documentaries that have been made about the war in the Middle East that have been just completely immersed with some of our troops. These young men wanted to make a film that had that same very intimate verite feel. And so the only way they could do that was to move to Memphis for the better part of 9 months. And the two directors, Dan Lindsay and T.J. Martin, shot 95% of the film that you see. So we typically had two cameras rolling during school hours, during practice hours, and they'd break up occasionally, and one would shoot something across town, they'd shoot together. But these guys literally shot morning to night and sometimes into the night, 6.5 days a week. It got to the point where they actually took a day off and didn't go to practice. And one of the players went up to Coach Bill and said, "Where are the guys? Why aren't they here?" They had literally become a part of the team. So I think the film is so intimate and feels almost like a scripted film because there's just not a whole lot of talking heads telling you what happened. You're actually seeing what happened. That it's really a huge commitment by the two directors and the producer to pick up their lives and move to Memphis for 9 months was a huge commitment by them.
You mentioned the players inquiring, "Hey, where are the cameras? We're used to them having them here." I'm sure this is something that a lot of people are going to think while they're watching it. How does that actually go about? Does the school have to sign a waiver, and then, you know, are the players told not to look at the cameras just to practice? Do the coaches give them, you know, any special pep talks? You know, really play up your action during practice. You know, how does the interaction work between the live cameras
and your last question about logistics, one of the big logistical things to deal with was, of course, access to the high school. And we had to jump through a lot of hoops and show them the intent of what we wanted to do and make sure that they understood what our purpose was to have the cameras there. And it wasn't easy. And they had several questions, and the contract ended up being a lengthy contract. But we were able to get that access. And the coaches on the first day, when Dan and Rich and TJ showed up, explained what they were doing and said, "Hey, they're here to document this season, good, bad, or otherwise. And if you don't want to be filmed, just stay away from the cameras. And if you don't want them here, tell us. But otherwise, they're just going to be here." And that was it. And what you start to realize, and we've been at this for a while with documentary films, with small crews where you don't have big boom mics and you don't have lights and you don't have a production truck and a catering trailer, you have three guys, and at most they'd get up to five when they were covering a game because we'd add two additional cameras. People forget you're there. and it just really does become natural life. And I think you'll see that in the film, where you really get to see these kids and coaches and the community in their truth, because they were there for so long, they just became literally flies on the wall.
Yeah, no, I mean, watching it, you feel like you forget you're watching a movie. You just feel like you're living with these guys, which is why I think it's so successful. Take me through Oscar night. What it was like to be there. You know, you got to go on stage. Explain how that whole experience was.
It's been surreal. That's the only word I can attach to this whole Oscars campaign and then being nominated, because there's these steps where you get shortlisted, meaning they take all of the qualified documentaries from the year and they whittle it down to 15. So we made that. And then you make it to the nomination phase, which is the top five of that 15, which we made that. And still the whole time thinking, okay, it's going to end any day now. And then you go to the theater for the show, and you've got your tux on, and it's all just kind of, you're going with the motions, because in your mind, at least in my mind, there's no way we're going to win. And then comes our time when they're going to announce the documentaries. And I literally don't remember anything but like three moments. Just, I kind of blanked out. I remember Seth Gordon, who's one of the producers on the film and rather large, almost running over Robert Downey Jr. on the stage. And then I remember one of our co-directors using a bad word during a live television broadcast in his speech. And then I remember how quickly they rush you off the stage for the next thing. Like, those are the only three things I really remember until I woke up in the lobby with a glass of champagne in my hand, celebrating.
Sounds like a whirlwind and a total blur, but I'm sure you can watch it back and remember more than you remember live.
I have gone back and watched. My wife recorded it on our DVR, and I've gone back and watched it and just realized, okay, yeah, that was real.
Nice. Now, I hear you had some success in football on your own. You mind just taking me quickly through your days playing in the Washington, D.C. area, down in Alexandria, and where you went from there, and how that ultimately brought you into ESPN and the movies?
Yeah, very lucky. I played at Mount Vernon High School in Alexandria. I was class of 87, and up through that point in the next couple of years, there was just a great coach there named Bruce Patrick. And he's in the Hall of Fame for Fairfax County, and just wonderful guy. That it was not just about football. It was about everything you did off the field and how you carried yourself. And so we got a lot of great lessons from Coach Patrick and the staff that he had, just a group of really dedicated, good guys. So I was good enough to get a scholarship to the University of Washington. So I left for the West Coast when I was 17 and have kind of been out here ever since. Lucky enough to have another great head coach at Washington named Don James, who doesn't get a whole lot of credit for the coaches that have come from him, but people who know college football know the name Nick Saban, who's the most successful current college coach. And Nick Saban gives a lot of credit to Don James because he was the first coach he ever worked for as a coach. And so Don James ran a program that it was very militaristic. You were on time. If you weren't 5 minutes early, you were late. I just learned so much about self-discipline through him. And then I was lucky enough to be drafted into the NFL. And I played 4 years for the Arizona Cardinals and then 1 year for the Seahawks. And I'd already started working in radio and television at the time as an announcer, kind of as a hobby, but it started to become a job. And I was ready to transition. So I transitioned into announcing first at CBS, and now I've been at ESPN ABC, specifically doing college football. And then I found myself in L.A., and I was trying to expand my job in front of the camera as an announcer. I was looking at doing some hosting stuff, of reality shows, things like that. And it just ended up, the easier career path was to become a producer. And so I started working as a producer in about 2003. And our first film was New York Doll, which was the story of Arthur Killer Kane, who was a founding member of the old glam punk rock band, the New York Dolls. So that was the first feature film I produced in, I think, 2004.
Okay. And I hear you were a part of King of Kong, too. You want to take me into that really fast?
Yeah, King of Kong came about while we were finishing up New York Doll. I found this great story in this great world, this group called Twin Galaxies, which kept all these great old video game records. And so we started filming in that world, and we met Steve Wiebe, who ended up becoming for a short while the world champion on Donkey Kong. But his nemesis at the time was a guy named Billy Mitchell, who we found fascinating. Again, it's like being at the cocktail party. The camera immediately goes to Billy Mitchell. And so we were able to capture a really neat story about the chase for the world record on Donkey Kong.
Man, well, it sounds like you've lived a pretty full life so far, and I'm sure plenty more to come. Thanks for joining us, Ed. This is great. Like I said, I love the movie, and congrats again, and I will be recommending everyone that I can to see it.